Good evening, everyone, and welcome back finally to another Tuesday Night Three-Part series. It's been a while since we were last learning together, since before Pesach, but it's good. It's good to be back and learning for the next 3 weeks. And turning to a topic that on the one hand, I feel like I have discussed time and time and time again for good reason, in a variety of fora in the shul, but at the same time, a topic that no matter how many times it gets discussed, needs to be discussed more and more, which is tefillah, which is prayer. And before even going any further with kind of the purpose, the aims of what we are going to be doing over the next 3 weeks, I want to already turn to the source sheet to kind of frame what it is we are going to be talking about. And I want to begin with a quote from Rav Soloveitchik, I really enjoy quoting. We're going to be reading a lot of Rav Soloveitchik tonight, but this quote is independent of that. And he writes the following. When I speak about, and I'm sure I've shared this source in the past, when I speak about the philosophy of prayer or Shema, I do not claim universal validity for my conclusions. I am not lecturing on philosophy of prayer as such, but on prayer as understood, experienced, and enjoyed by an individual. I acquaint you with my own personal experience. Whether taking into consideration the differences between minds and the peculiarities of the individual, my experience can be detached from my idiosyncrasies and transferred to others, I do not know. Rav Soloveitchik points out at the beginning of one of his books on tefillah, which we will talk more about soon, that it's kind of impossible to talk about the philosophy of tefillah from a general perspective. There are some things we can say, but fundamentally talking about tefillah is a deeply personal experience. A person can share with another what they connect to in davening, what they find significant, what they find powerful with davening. And it's really, to a certain extent, up to luck, up to chance, whether or not the person on the other end will actually appreciate what it is that they are, what the personal reflections are, and whether they resonate. And so I wanted to devote a series to tefillah slightly more philosophically, slightly more programmatically, but at the same time, this entire series, far more than other series that I do, is just suffused with my own kind of personal attempts to find davening better and more meaningful. Obviously, whenever I give a shiur, realistically, I'm sharing things that speak to me. I'm sharing ideas that I find compelling and interesting, but this more than any other. At the end of the day, if an idea about davening doesn't resonate, I'm not really going to be particularly interested in sharing it. And so my goal over the next 3 weeks is to share three different approaches to tefillah. I titled them, the subtitle of this series was The Mechanical, The Mystical, and The Magical. And I'll be honest, I came up with that title before I knew the three figures we would be discussing, but I had a rough idea of what I wanted to talk, who I wanted to look at and analyze. But I want to share over these next 3 weeks three different approaches to prayer in the hope that tefillah can be more meaningful for all of us, which is not easy. Another source I always find myself quoting for one reason or another is the Yerushalmi in Brachot. And it says the following, Amar Rabbi Chiya Ruba, the great Rabbi Chiya said, Ana min yomai lo chavnit el achad zman, be'im mechavna, ve'hirharit bilibi. I have never been able to daven with kavana. This is one of the great sages. I've never, ever been able to properly pray with intent. One time I really, really tried to. Va'amrit, and I said to myself, Man alel kome malka. Who appears before the king? Who enters first? Kadami. Arkebasa or Resh Guluta? Is the commander of the palace? Or the head of the exile, who enters first? In other words, and we've all been there, right? This davening is going to be different. I'm actually going to concentrate this time. How many times happened to me this afternoon in shul? This mincha, I am finally, this is going to be a good mincha. And within, I kid you not, 5 seconds of starting mincha, all of a sudden my mind drifts to something else. That is our experience. No matter how many times we try to daven, sometimes it just doesn't seem to work. The Gemara continues, by the way, in the Yerushalmi, Shmuel Amar Ana Manit Efrochaya. I count chicks. He counts the animals he sees outside the window. Rebbe Bun Barchia Amar Ana Manit De Mosia. I count stone rose. Amar Rabbi Matanya Ana Mechazek Tuva Leroshi. Dechad Have Mate Modim Huchra Migarame. I am so grateful to my head that when I reach Modim, it bows by itself. Again, I'm sure we've all been there. We are davening the Amidah and we are distracted and we happen to realize, oh, look at that. We've reached the end of davening. We find ourselves taking 3 steps back without even realizing that that's the case. This is, I think, our great challenge in davening. The just impossibility to concentrate. And so one goal of this 3-part series is to infuse our davening with greater meaning so that, again, we might all find ourselves like Rabbi Chia, we'll have more desire to daven with Kavana, but it might not matter. But I can say from personal experience, having already prepared, you know, these shiurim and therefore having already had an opportunity to have my davening enriched, it helps somewhat, though my example about Mincha not working out this afternoon proves that it's never quite solved. Another reason to focus on tefillah. So I came across a quote attributed to Lord Sacks. I didn't have a chance to verify if it was something he actually said, but it was words to the effect of, if we were to gather all the tears that have ever been cried by modern Orthodox Jews when davening, we wouldn't even fill a cup. Which is to say that we don't necessarily find within davening that same power and passion that we think we should. And whether or not we should is actually going to be one of the questions hanging over everything we talk about tonight and over the next, you know, 3 weeks. But the other aspect to davening is to infuse it with a little bit more meaning, a little bit more power. I think sometimes when we try to infuse our davening with more meaning, we look for maybe shortcuts. We look for maybe other avenues and angles to feel more passionately about davening. But maybe just talking about learning about different approaches to tefillah can actually infuse our davening with a little bit more of that passion. The 3 perspectives that we're going to be talking about over the next three weeks, are interestingly all from the same philosophical world. So when we did, I kind of already talked about this when we did 3 approaches to teshuva, right? We had a little bit of a variance. The truth is, if all 3 of the figures we are talking about would have lived at the same time, they all would have been sat next to each other in the same yeshiva. Because the 3 figures we are going to be talking about tonight, Rav Soloveitchik's perspective on prayer, that's the mechanical. Next week, we're going to be talking about Rav Kook's philosophy of prayer, Rav Kook, the kind of grandfather of religious Zionism, that's the mystical. And then the final week, the magical, is Reb Chaim of Volozhin. Reb Chaim of Volozhin is a legendary figure of Jewish history. He is the founder of the Volozhin Yeshiva, one of the students of the Vilna Gaon, and a fascinating figure in his own right. So he founded Volozhin Yeshiva. Volozhin Yeshiva is where Rav Kook attended. And Rav Soloveitchik, even though he never attended Volozhin Yeshiva, he nonetheless was a descendant of the Yeshiva of Volozhin. The Soloveitchiks were very much part and parcel of the Yeshiva when it had existed and when they had lived in Europe. So to a certain extent, we're looking at 3 people who all are shades of one another philosophically, and yet, as we are going to see, incredibly different and varying views the entire time. Something that's really important to clarify from the beginning for this entire series is that when we talk about the word prayer, when we talk about the word tefillah, it can mean 1 of 3 things. One way is, and I sometimes use the term sa'aka, outcry. Sometimes when we think of prayer, we think about spontaneous prayer, We are vexed by something, we are upset by something, we are hopeful for something, and we find ourselves davening to Hashem. That's spontaneous. Again, that's more outcry. The technical term would be tza'aka. That's not what we are talking about. We are obviously talking about formal tefillah, the expectation that three times a day we take a siddur in our hand and we daven from it. But even still, that tefillah prayer can colloquially refer to all the contents of the siddur. Right? If you were to start davening shacharit, you have the early brachot, you have psukei dezimra, you have the brachot of the shema itself, you have the amidah, you have all the stuff afterwards, you have all of these things that we would refer to as tefillah, as prayer. That's not what we're talking about either, broadly speaking. When I talk about tefillah, I mean it in the most technical sense, which is the amidah. While all the other aspects of prayer are important, and definitely the things we are going to be talking about, if they confuse our amidah with greater meaning, how much more so other parts of davening also. But the fundamental question that we are really, the topic when we talk about prayer, tefillah, we are really talking about the amidah itself. The purpose of why we pray, the center point, the focal point of davening. And this brings us to a fundamental question asked by Rabbi Yosef Albo, one of the medieval thinkers of the Jewish world. And he writes the following. The reason which leads people to doubt the point of davening is the same thing that leads them to deny essentially God himself. V'zeshehim omrim. This is what they say. Shelo yemaleit hadavar machluka im shenigzar mehashem tov ma al ha'ish ma olo nigzar. Either God has determined what's going to happen to us, or he's not. V'im nigzar ein sarich l'tfila. If God has already determined what's going to happen to us, if our futures are predestined, by the way, we will be devoting Tikkun El Shavuot. I wasn't even intentional to this plug, but we will be devoting Tikkun El Shavuot to an exploration of the topic of free will. But says Rav Yosef Albo, there are those who point out, what's the point of davening if God's already decreed what will happen to us? V'im lo nigzar, and if God has not determined what's going to happen, what's the point of praying? God's not bothered to decree what's going to happen to you. And so, why bother praying to him? God does not change what's happening. If things have already happened, they've already happened. He's not going to change things. There's absolutely no point basically praying. That God's not going to do anything for you. Right? This fundamental question that we will see bothers Rav Soloveitchik too. What is the point of prayer? How is it even possible for us to actually get up before God and ask things of him? Every time we do the Amidah tomorrow morning, Shacharit at BIV is at 6:30, we will reach the Amidah and we will stand before God and we will ask him four things. It says Rav Yosef Albo, he doesn't ask this question, but others do. What's the point? Either things have already been decreed or they've not been. And if they've not been, things aren't going to get decreed. For one flavor or another, this is always the fundamental question of davening. What exactly are we doing? What is its purpose? But before we turn to Rav Soloveitchik's perspective on prayer, there's a caveat specifically when talking about Rav Soloveitchik. It's also true of Rav Chaim Volozhin, which again shouldn't surprise us, but it's that the significance of davening was not fundamental in the eyes of Rav Soloveitchik. So there are a few sources to quote that kind of help frame this. The first is the Gemara in Shabbat, source number 4. Rava Chazye l'Rav Hamanuna, de kam ma'arich bitzlote. Rav or Rav Hamanuna taking a long time in his daven. Amar manichin chaye olam v'oskim b'chaye sha'ah. Look at these people taking too long to daven. They are abandoning eternal life, which is the study of Torah. And instead, they're spending all of their time just focusing on the present, which is prayer. V'hu savar. Zman tefillah l'chud, uzman Torah l'chud. But Rav Hamanuna thought differently. There are separate times for learning, and there are separate points for davening. But we already see here, Rava was skeptical of those who devoted too much time to their davening. Far more important to learn Torah. And indeed, this is how Rambam frames things. Mish, source number five, Misha haya osek betalmud Torah. Someone who is learning Torah. V'higia zman hatfilah, and they arrive at the time to daven. Posek umit palel, you stop learning and you daven. V'im hayta torata umenata. But if you study Torah as your full-time job, ve'ena osa malacha klal, and you don't do any other work at all, v'haya osek b'Torah b'shat tefilato ena posek, and you're learning Torah, you're in kolal, and you're learning Torah, and then the time of davening arrives, you don't stop to daven. Shemitzvat talmud Torah gedola mimitzvat tefilah, because Torah study is greater than davening. This is an explicit source in Rambam that if not, we still have to daven, we always have to daven, but if we actually have to frame which one is more important, Torah learning is more important than davening. Similarly, Rav Soloveitchik attached tremendous significance to the Gemara in Megillah, source number six, Va'amar Rav Papi Mishmeya Derava, Mibei Knishta Levei Rabbanan, if you want to convert a shul into a Beit Midrash for learning, Shrei, that's permitted, Mibei Rabbanan Levei Knishta, but if you want to turn a Beit Midrash into a shul, Asir, that's prohibited. Said Rav Soloveitchik again, learning is more important than davening. And therefore, learning is actually on a higher plane than davening. That being said, as Rav Lichtenstein, Rav Soloveitchik's son-in-law, points out, source number seven, those closest to him remember with admiration not only his brilliant lectures, his Torah learning, but also the broken heart filled with longing, which characterized his stance as a servant of God standing before his master during the Ne'ilah prayer on Yom Kippur, and the ecstasy and power which burst forth during his recitation of Nishmat Kol Chai at the Seder table. Despite Rav Soloveitchik's elevation of Torah learning over davening, he still took davening seriously. He cared. For him, it was incredibly important, incredibly powerful. But, and this will also be true when we talk about Rav Chaim Volozhin in week three, they still ranked Torah learning as the more important of the two. When it comes to talking about Rav Soloveitchik's approach to davening, we could take a three-part series, and that would be series A. We could take another three-part series, that would be series B. We could take another three-part series, Series C, and even with ABC 9 weeks devoted to it, we would barely scratch the surface. Rav Soloveitchik talked about davening a lot. He actually devoted so many of his public lectures to exploring the themes of davening because he thought it was one of the most important ideas for people to internalize. His views on davening are scattered throughout all of his articles. There is a book published posthumously entitled Worship of the Heart, which is a collection of some of his, I don't want to say best known ideas, but some of his most fundamental ideas on davening. But if you want to get a sense of just like the depth of what's in here, I also own a book that's on worship of the heart that explains it from a philosophical lens, which just don't let these a few tags fool you that it makes it look like I've read this book. I tried to get through it and I gave up because it is impossible and very boring, but hopefully one day I will actually extract information from it. All this is to say, there's a lot to talk about with Rav Soloveitchik's view on davening, but I want to keep this within the remit of the mechanical. Even though I came up with that word before I decided exactly what I wanted to talk about with Rav Soloveitchik, as we will see, Rav Soloveitchik's viewpoint of davening is very practically orientated. And it begins with a recognition of what we are doing when we daven. When we begin the Amidah, we take three steps back and 3 steps forward. The Gemara in Brachot says, Amar Rav Hamanuna, Kama Hilchata Gibarota Ikala Mishme Mehane Kredachana. How many different laws are learned from the episode of Chana's prayer? And in the ellipses, it goes through a lot of them, including Vayachshaveha Eli Lishikora. Eli, the priest, thought she was drunk. Mikan Sheshikor Asur Lehit Palel. From here, we learn that it is prohibited to be drunk, to daven while drunk. It's not as dangerous as driving while drunk, but still equally prohibited, equally problematic. So for a lot of different commentators, they have lots and lots of different explanations of why. Rav Soloveitchik believed in a very, very simple explanation of this Gemara. When you take 3 steps back and 3 steps forward, you are omed lifnei hamelech. You are standing in the presence of the king, of God, and it goes without saying. You aren't not drunk when you appear before a king. Oh, I mean, I get it. I am English. You are American. You might not have that much inherent knowledge of etiquette around monarchy, but trust me, you don't want to be drunk in front of royalty. Not that I have ever appeared before royalty, but if I were to, I know not to be drunk. Equally important, and to further prove this point, is Rashi's explanation of a Gemara in Brachot. The Gemara in Brachot says, we're going to have lots of quotes from different parts of Masechet Brachot tonight. Amar Rav Huna haita talito chaguro lo al matanav. So if you have your garment tied just above your waist, we're talking about a man here who is bare-chested. Mutar likrot kriyat shema. You can still read Shema. You can still fulfill your mitzvah of Shema without a t-shirt on. Aval litfila, but when it comes to the Amidah, ad sheichase et liba, you have to cover your heart. In other words, you have to be fully clothed. As Rashi explains, sarich hu laharot et atzmo ka'omed lifnei hamelech, because you need to see yourself as standing before a king. V'la'amod be'ema, and therefore you stand in awe. Aval kriyat shema eino medaber lifnei hamelech, but when it comes to saying Shema, we're not standing before the king. The fundamental stance of the Amidah, the most important thing for us to understand, is that we are, for Rav Soloveitchik's perspective, begins by recognizing we are omed lifnei hamelech. Interestingly, I don't want to get into this right now because it's detailed and it's a tangent, but famously, Rav Soloveitchik did not believe the Omid Lifnei HaMelech applied to the repetition of the Amidah, which is why he doesn't think when the Shaliach Tzibor, when the Chazan has finished the public recitation of the Amidah, the Chazarat HaShatz, he doesn't think you need to take 3 steps backwards, because you take 3 steps backwards to leave the presence of the king, but the repetition of the Amidah was never Omid Lifnei HaMelech, but our private Amidah is Omid Lifnei HaMelech, which is why we take 3 steps backwards, we take 3 steps forward to enter his presence, we avail ourselves of his presence at the end by taking another 3 steps back and bowing politely, right? The whole idea is being omed lifnei hamelech. When we daven the Amidah, in and of itself, this is powerful imagery. We have a private audience with the King of Kings. However, this raises a problem. Says Rav Soloveitchik, source number 10, relating to God through speech and supplication, appears to our sages as a brazen and adventurous activity. How can mortal man, who is today here and tomorrow in the grave, approach the Supreme King, the Holy One, blessed be he? Does an ordinary subject have the license to speak to a great and exalted king and petition him for his needs? If this is the case, what is the character of prayer? The whole substance of prayer as petition and supplication for man's petty needs, as we have indicated, is puzzling and beyond our ken. Can man attain a foothold within divine transcendence? Can he shower him with a plethora of insignificant matters? This is the fundamental challenge. Again, we saw Rav Yosef Albo ask it in a philosophical sense. Rav Soloveitchik asks it almost in an emotional sense. We stand omed lifnei hamelech, we stand before the King of Kings, and we ask him, in some cases, for the most meaningless and petty things, and even the big things, even the serious things we ask for to an infinite being of infinite power are small and insignificant. There is an audacity, a chutzpah, to tefillah which boggles the mind and requires explanation. What on earth allows us to do so? And this leads Rav Soloveitchik to one of his more interesting ideas of davening. And it's an idea I didn't bother putting it on the source sheet, I don't believe. We will find out together as we scroll further down if I ended up doing so. Even Rav Lichtenstein admits that he struggled with Rav Soloveitchik's insistence that davening makes no sense. So it's a tough idea. But Rav Soloveitchik believed, his celebrated view was that tefillah requires what we call a matir, permission. So this is a specific class of mitzvot or ideas. The best example of this might be shechita, ritual slaughter. We are allowed to eat meat. However, we have a problem. How can we eat meat? The answer is shechita comes along, ritual slaughter comes along, and ensures that the meat we eat is kosher. Shechita, therefore, is a matir. It exists to permit us something else. It doesn't exist in its own right. There is no value to shechita itself. If we weren't eating meat, we would not otherwise encourage people to slaughter cows. But we need to be able to eat meat. We need the matir, and therefore shechita exists. For Rav Soloveitchik, tefillah requires a matir. We need to be able to point at something. It's not per se a mitzvah like shechita, but the concept is the same. We need to be able to point at something and say that allows us to daven. That allows us to pray. And Rav Soloveitchik would point to many different examples of a matir. The best known example is the famous Gemara in Berachot. I didn't bother putting it on the source sheet because I quote it so often. Tefilot avot tiknum, that the prayers were instituted by our forefathers, by Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. How do we know we can pray? Because our forefathers did, right? This audacious chutzpahdik act that we should not be allowed to do. Well, hold on a second. Great, 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 great grandpappy Avraham prayed. And so we can pray too. That's one matir. That's one historical, traditional validation of the act and audacity of prayer. Another matir is the famous fact that Rav Soloveitchik felt it was famous. As we look in source number 11, Rambam's Sefer HaMitzvot, Rambam goes through and lists the 613 mitzvot in the Torah. When it comes to positive mitzvah number 5, Hushetzivanu le'ovdo, we are commanded to serve God. Ukvar nichbal zeh hatzivoy pa'amim, this command is mentioned many, many times. One example, v'lashon sifrei ovdo, zo tfila. To serve God is to pray. Rav Soloveitchik has this whole beautiful idea that Rambam saved davening. He redeemed davening. Because everyone else thinks davening is rabbinic. Ramban Nachmanides thinks that davening is the institution of formal prayer is a rabbinic command, and it's just crying out in need that's biblical. When you're in crisis, you cry out to God. But not so Rambam, says Rav Soloveitchik. Rambam thinks we have a biblical obligation to pray, and for this reason, we once again have a matir. How do we know we can pray to God? Well, he told us to do so. And if he tells us to do so, by definition, that's permission. If I told you to do something, it doesn't matter how chutzpahdik it is. If I ask you to do it, if I require you to do it, then you have permission by definition. Similarly, is the Gemara again in Brachot, which points out Yachol Yitpalel Adam Kol Hayom Kulo. You might think that you can pray every single all points in the day as often as you'd like. Kavar meforash al yidei Daniel, and therefore Sefer Daniel, the book of Daniel, says in reference to Daniel's prayer, v'zimnim tlata, he did it 3 times a day. right? We know that there are a maximum of three times a day, unless obviously it's Shabbos, Yom Tov, or Yom Kippur. There are only three times a day. There are only three times a day that we can pray. There are windows of time to pray. Again, this exists in some sense as a matter, as permission. There is an opportunity. It's not just we are appearing before God to beg him for things, but he is inviting us to do so. There is a small but limited set of opportunities to turn to God in prayer, three times a day, and that's it. This is another matter. And finally, though this in and of itself is an entire, again, multi-part series, Rav Soloveitchik thought, especially if we think about Shacharit, one major purpose of Pesukei Dezimra, one major purpose of all of the brachot surrounding Shema, we are just praising God left, right, and center, is all about creating a matter to daven. That we need to give ourselves permission to daven, and we do so with all the, it's one giant run-up to the Amidah. It's all about a matter. There's a lot of different examples, but they all serve the same purpose. The act of prayer, the act of davening the Amidah, is one in which we are omed lifnei hamelech. We stand before the king. And that grants us a tremendous opportunity, but a hard to conceive, hard to consider, to understand opportunity to ask God for things. No, God commands us, he invites us to pray to him with our petty needs. And for that reason, it is legitimate. We thus find ourselves, we'll find ourselves tomorrow morning in Shacharit, Omed Lefnei HaMelech, with permission. Why do we pray? So until now, we've understood what is going on with prayer, what it is, and why we're allowed to do it. But what is it exactly that we are doing? Source number 13 says the following about the structure of the Amidah. Amar Rav Yehuda, Le'olam al yish'al adam tzrachav. A person must never request his own needs when it comes to the Amidah, specifically, lo b'shalosh rishonot v'lo b'shalosh acharonot, neither in the first three brachot of the Amidah nor the final three, ela be'emtza iyot, rather only in the middle brachot. The Amar Rabbi Chanina, for as Rabbi Chanina would explain, rishonot, those first three brachot, right, Magen Avraham, Mechaye Hametim, and Hakel Hakadosh, Dome le'eved shemesader shevach lifnei rabo. It's like a servant who begins whatever they're doing, praising extensively their master. Emtzaiyot, when it comes to the middle brachot, all of them, these are the requests, the bakashot. Dome le'eved shemevakesh pras mirabo. That's when we are like a servant who is requesting something. Acharonot, when it comes to the final brachot. Dome le'eved shekibel pras mirabo. We are like a servant who's now received what we asked for, a reward. V'niftar v'holechla, and therefore we are taking leave and going. Right? This is a famous, well-known, at least in the broad strokes, idea that before we ask God for our requests, we have to do essentially a complimentary sandwich. The bread is praise, thanksgiving, glorification. And the middle, the filling, is all of the requests. That's the fundamental principle at the heart of our davening. But there's something to note here. If we look a little bit closer, the examples are telling a story. Why is the servant there? The servant is there for an obvious reason, to make a request. The master knows it. They're not fooled by, oh, you're being so complimentary. Wow. Oh, and you decided to ask me something? Great. Sure. Of course, now you've been, so no, everyone knows. It's all a grand charade. Everyone knows that the servant is going through this performatory exercise to make a request of their master, and therefore, bakasha, requests prayer, requests asking for things, is really the entirety of the Amidah. Sure, the first three, we're not technically asking for anything. And the final three, we're not technically asking for something, but it's part of the packaging of asking for something. The reason we found ourselves saying the first three brachot and last three brachot was to get to the middle brachot. In other words, we have one single purpose when we daven the Amidah. Asking for stuff. We are thanking God. We are asking God, requesting God for something. Sure, we start with praise, but that's only the polite, awkward beginning conversation. You know, I mean, I've not yet really tried to stab at fundraising from anyone in the shul, though. Let me know if this sounds like it would be appealing to you, and then I can try it out on all of you. But if I began with, like, you know, so-and-so, you're just such a fine contributor to our community, which would be true. And you are someone who we value so highly, which would be true. But you would know, but I'm not just doing that randomly. I didn't ask to meet with you to make this special meeting just to compliment you. I wanted something from you. That's what we're doing with the Amidah. So even the compliments, even the niceties, let's be honest, it's still a request. And that is the sole purpose of the Amidah. If we were to put it in the most Rav Soloveitchik language possible, it's just one word. The Amidah prayer is about crisis. We throw ourselves upon God because we are in crisis. And for that reason, Rav Soloveitchik had little patience for philosophies that diminished the significance of making a request. There are definitely philosophies of prayers out there which don't want us to focus on asking for things. They don't want us to make our requests. And says Rav Soloveitchik, source 14, even though, as noted, prayer requires praise and thanksgiving, nonetheless, the vigor and power of prayer derive from petition. Halacha is interested in psychosomatic man, in his concrete corporeality. That's the most like Rav Soloveitchik sentence. It is displeased by the ecstatic separation of soul from body during prayer. The aim of worship of the heart is the offering of sacrifice through total surrender of body and soul to God. We'll come back to that final line in a second. But the point is, our petty needs that reveal our crisis are exactly what should be focused on. Because when we throw ourselves at God begging for something, that's the whole point. God wants us to be real. God wants us to ask things of him. The whole notion behind davening is for us to request of God our needs, for us to recognize our reality, right? We need money. We need health. We need this. We need that. We need help. That is exactly what we are supposed to be doing. That is the significance, and that is the importance of davening. I'd mentioned before, Rav Soloveitchik, and I'll scroll up actually to Rav Soloveitchik's, to Rambam's definition of davening as being biblical. And I'd mentioned that Ramban disagrees, that Ramban thinks you only ever have a biblical command to pray when you are in crisis, in Sa'aka. Rav Soloveitchik thinks Rambam agrees. It's just Rambam subscribes to the belief that Rav Soloveitchik subscribes to, which is that we are always in crisis. There is never a moment, and again, this is maybe, you know, get on our psychology, armchair psychologists, and we can start to think about the fact that, you know, Rav Soloveitchik thought the natural state of human being was to be plagued by crisis, existential crisis, this, that, okay. But the point is, the power here is, chances are we are probably in some sort of crisis most times, and the point of davening is for that. And so before we go to the final piece that I want to share about Rav Soloveitchik's idea, I already want to stress the power of this. Because I think, admittedly, I've been inspired by this idea for long enough that I don't think there's anything bad to davening in crisis. But I feel like there can sometimes be this attitude that if we are not davening for its own sake, if we're not davening because we're in crisis, we're kind of doing it wrong. Says Rav Soloveitchik, no. Someone did ask a question that maybe relates to this, which is that if they are reciting the Amidah for the sake of doing it in order to daven, are they doing it wrong? No, but the point is, and I think I've talked about this angle before in other contexts. Perhaps another way to frame it is, what is the baseline default of davening? And if the baseline default of davening is crisis, what that means is that it's designed for us to be in crisis. If we're not in crisis, or we don't feel like sharing our crises with God at any given moment, we're not davening wrong. We're just not taking full advantage, or we're not, that sounds negative, but like, we're just not using all that's available to us. But fundamentally, that's okay. But if it wasn't built for crisis, when we found ourselves in crisis, we'd be struggling with the Amidah. Mindy has a question.
Would you repeat one more time the concept that Rambam says that it's biblical? Is it biblically permissible or biblically commanded, and what that source referred back to?
Yes. So Rambam says in the Sefer Mitzvot, we have a positive biblical obligation to pray, which Rav Soloveitchik sees as one example of a matir, one example of giving license to us to stand before the king and actually ask him for our petty needs. I see other questions coming in, but I do want to finish this final point, because this is the most Rav Soloveitchik thing of them all. So we're standing Omeid Lifnei HaMelech. We're standing before the king, which we know we're allowed to do, and we're in crisis. The fundamental question then becomes, okay, but what's the text of the Amidah? What's the purpose of the Siddur itself and all of the various mechanics that go along? How exactly does all of that interact with davening? So for Rav Soloveitchik, davening is the perfect example of a distinction he liked to make in a number of contexts, which is the distinction between, all together, for those of you who've heard Rav Soloveitchik's distinctions before, the Kiyum and the Ma'aseh. The Kiyum is the fulfillment of the mitzvah, and the Ma'aseh is the act. If we think of an obvious example where the two just are the same, eating matzah on Pesach. You have a mitzvah to eat matzah on Pesach. And so how do you fulfill that mitzvah? Well, you eat it, boom, right? We gave a lot of nice, big reasons that I've now forgotten about eating matzah before Pesach, but fundamentally, the mitzvah is fulfilled through the very act itself. An example of the contrast with this is the laws of Avelut, the laws of mourning. For Rav Soloveitchik, there are these various acts we are supposed to do, the act of sitting shiva when one has lost a loved one. Right, but the point is, you don't, to a certain extent, it's not to just check the box. Oh, I sat in a low chair. The sitting in a low chair and all the other restrictions are supposed to give oneself a sense of moroseness. And the kiyum, the ma'aseh, is sitting, but the kiyum is fulfilled through a certain level of sadness. For Rav Soloveitchik, the ultimate example of kiyum and ma'aseh is davening. The ma'aseh is the text of prayer. But the kiyum is the requests from God. And this kind of goes back to the question I was asked before, which is, you know, if you just say the text, well, you have to have in mind a certain level of what you are fulfilling. But for Rav Soloveitchik, what you're really, really giving voice to is your crisis. And that's not to say you didn't fulfill your obligation of Amidah if you weren't in crisis, because, or maybe Rav Soloveitchik might go that far to say, but other people wouldn't. But the point is, you the sense of crisis is conveyed by the text itself. I sometimes like to use the term that the text is a springboard. So as we're reading through, and we're reading through, you know, the classic example of a tachonein is when one is about to face a test, you ask for knowledge, but there are other situations where we would like knowledge too. That would be good. Refa'ina was an obvious one where we ask for health. Barich Aleinu, where we ask for parnas. Right? There's a lot of Re'ev Yonina, we ask God to redeem us. Right? There are so many different requests, personal and national, that can possibly spark our recognition of a crisis, of a funk, of some sort of challenge within us. And the text gives voice to those, but the kiyum is found within our minds. But the ultimate purpose of davening, what this reaches its, I don't know if apotheosis is the right word, so I'll just say peak. As we saw at the end of source number 14, the aim of worship of the heart is the offering of sacrifice through total surrender of body and soul to God. This crisis is not just about me asking God for stuff, though that's why I'm there in the first place. There's a bigger reason to it. As Rav Soloveitchik wrote in source number 15, yet there is another aspect to prayer. Prayer is an act of giving away. Prayer means sacrifice, unrestricted offering of the whole self, the return to God of body and soul, everything one possesses and cherishes. There is an altar in heaven upon which the archangel Michael offers the souls of the righteous. Thrice daily we petition God to accept our prayers as well as the fires, the self-sacrifices of Israel on the altar, v'ishe Yisrael u'tfilatam bi'ahavat kabel baratzon. Prayer is rooted in the idea that man belongs not to himself, but that God claims man, and that his claim to man is not partial, but total. God the Almighty sometimes wills man to place himself, like Yitzchak of old, on the altar, to light the fire and to be consumed as a burnt offering. When we are davening to God in crisis, it's not simply about begging God to do something. It's about the recognition that we are nothing without him. That self-sacrifice. When we ask people for help, when we truly ask people for help, we recognize to a certain extent that we exist at their mercy, that we exist, you know, at their decisions, at their power. That's the ultimate point of tefillah, says Rav Soloveitchik. Sacrifice. We are there to sacrifice ourselves to God, to be korbanot, to be offerings upon the altar before God. We stand omid lifnei hamelach, which we are allowed to do, and everything we do serves the act of bakasha, the act of requests. We ask God for things because we are deep in crisis. But in doing so, we recognize his power. We recognize, we throw ourselves at his proverbial feet, and we recognize he alone can help us. And in doing so, we give off our entire selves to God in the process. The fundamental purpose of tefillah is self-sacrifice. And Rav Soloveitchik gets there, in the end, an emotional idea. But he gets there through the mechanical, through technical halachic notions. Omid lifnei hamelech, matir, bakasha. These are all halachic notions. But by weaving together these halachic concepts, Rav Soloveitchik builds a philosophical edifice of prayer. As I said, he says so much about davening that there are 15,000 different, that's an exaggeration, sometimes people don't think I'm exaggerating, 15,000 different angles through which we could understand Rav Soloveitchik. But this one I think is the most important. The entire act of davening halachically is built to give voice to our crisis. Tomorrow morning in Shacharit, when we daven the Amidah, if we are fortunate to not be distracted, if we are fortunate, sometimes, as I often say, for the best of reasons, we can't make it. But if we are fortunate to be able to daven with Kavana, tefillah gives voice to our crisis. But it's not simply about, and I think this is the fundamental answer too. We don't just need a matir. How can we ask God of our petty needs? But the reality is, the act of prayer itself is not just about asking God for our petty needs. The act of davening is about the self-sacrifice, the throwing ourselves at the Ribono Shel Olam, and in doing so, realizing our fundamental dependence on him. And that is a purpose of tefillah. And as we will see, please God, next week with Rav Kook, there are entirely, completely different ways of understanding the significance of davening. So if this idea resonated with you, great. Please still come back next week because maybe things will still resonate. I genuinely believe each of these three ideas we're going to talk about will have resonance each time. But if you felt Rav Soloveitchik didn't speak to you, that's okay. Wait one more week and maybe Rav Kook's entirely different approach will do so.